And I'm hoping that you'll allow me this evening one last foray into John Calvin this anniversary year. A few months ago, we considered Calvin on self-denial. Last week, we considered Calvin on prayer. And tonight, I'd like us just for a few moments to consider Calvin on Christian liberty. And then after that, I'm done with John Calvin, for the time being at least. Christian liberty, then. I suppose that for some of you, that may be a phrase which is immediately recognizable. You may have thought about it, read about it, heard talks about it many times in the past. For others of you, however, that may not be the case. And you may be wondering, A, what Christian liberty is, what it means, and B, why it deserves specific consideration this evening. Well, with regard to the first question, what is it? Hopefully that will become clear as we proceed this evening. But with that regard to the second question, why does it deserve specific consideration this evening? Perhaps I could just quote from the way Calvin introduces this subject at the beginning of the chapter. By the way, it's in Calvin's Institutes, book 3 in chapter 19, if you're interested. And he writes this at the start of the chapter. He says, "It is a subject of the first importance, and unless it be well understood, our consciences scarcely venture to undertake anything without doubting, experiencing in many things hesitation and reluctance, and always being subject to fluctuations and fears." And so he's saying then that the health and well-being of our consciences, or perhaps a more colloquial way of putting it would be our peace of mind. Our peace of mind depends on us understanding this subject. If we're going to have peace of mind as Christians, if we're not going to be continually dogged by these doubts and hesitations and fears that he mentions there, then we need to have a clear understanding of this subject, Christian liberty. Well, Calvin suggests then that there are three aspects to Christian liberty. Three aspects to this freedom then, this emancipation, which is our basic birthright as children of God. First of all then, liberty from justification by works. Liberty from justification by works. I'm sure most of you will know what I mean then by this word justification. By justification, we mean that state of being right with God, that state of being accepted and approved and acquitted by the divine judge. And justification by works, then, is achieving that status through our own efforts, by keeping that judge's law, keeping God's law perfectly and fully and completely. Justification by works is achieving God's acceptance and approval by perfectly keeping his law. And Calvin is saying then that we have liberty from that. We're free from that. We're free from gaining God's acceptance by our own efforts. Let me quote him. He writes this: "The consciences of believers, when seeking an assurance of their justification before God, should forget all the righteousness of the law, avoiding all mention of the law, and dismissing all thoughts of their own works. We must embrace the divine mercy alone, and turning our eyes from ourselves, fix them solely on Christ." A wonderful summary that at the end there, isn't it? Turning our eyes from ourselves, fix them solely on Christ. Or just a couple of paragraphs later, he continues, "When believers' consciences are anxious how God may be propitiated," propitiated means appeased, "how God may be appeased, how his wrath, his hostility, his antagonism toward us may be removed." So when believers' consciences are anxious how God may be appeased or propitiated, "and on what they shall rest their confidence if called to his tribunal, there must then be no consideration of the law, but Christ alone." And Calvin doesn't say much more than that. It's obviously a theme which he expands in more detail in other parts of his institutes, and I don't think we need to expand it any more than that tonight. But just to remind you of the glory of that, that as Christians we are free from having to earn God's acceptance by our own efforts. Imagine how tormented we would be tonight if even just the slightest bit of our acceptance with God hinged upon our own efforts. If something about our behaviour today contributed to our standing before God, well, we would be in a very miserable state indeed, wouldn't we? The wonder and the glory of this, that our standing before God is absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with our law keeping, with our obedience, with our performance, with our behaviour, with our ethics, with our lifestyle. It's altogether grounded in the work of Jesus Christ. So we have liberty then from justification by works. Secondly, Calvin says, we have liberty from terrified and reluctant obedience. Liberty from terrified and reluctant obedience. Because, of course, justified people, those who have been justified through faith in Jesus Christ, do then live a life of obedience, don't they? We talked about that in our recent series on holiness. It'll become clear in our studies in the book of Deuteronomy that Christians, believing people, don't just live any old lives. They do live lives of obedience, and specifically obedience to God's law. Calvin says that the fact that we're not justified by works, this will not authorize anyone to conclude that the law is of no use to believers, stress to believers, whom it does still continue to instruct and exhort. So the law is of no use, of course, to unbelievers trying to be saved, but it is of use to believers whom it does still continue to instruct and exhort. But Calvin's point then is that as believers who do then obey God's law and who do live lives of obedience, we do it in such a different way from those who are trying to obey the law to earn their acceptance with God. Listen to what he says. He says, believers' consciences do not observe the law as being under any legal obligation, but they yield a voluntary obedience to the will of God. In other words, you see, our obedience as Christians isn't, oh, I've got to do this in order to avoid the curse. I've got to keep these rules. I've got to keep these commands in order to avoid God's punishment and God's wrath and God's judgment. That's not the spirit in which we do it. No, we do it now because we want to do it. Because God has saved us by his grace and he has won our hearts to him. And now we want to obey him. And so there's this completely different spirit in which we now as Christians obey the law. He continues, how could unhappy souls apply themselves with cheerful readiness to any work for which they expect to receive nothing but a curse? In other words, if you're obeying the law and there's still all these threats and curses hanging over it, then there's no possibility of cheerful obedience. On the contrary, however, if they are liberated from the severe exaction of the law and hear God calling them with paternal gentleness, then with cheerfulness and promptness they will answer to his call and follow his guidance. Then he uses this illustration. Children hesitate not to present to their parents their imperfect and faulty works in confidence that their obedience will be accepted by them, though they have not performed all that they wished. Such children ought we to be, Calvin says, feeling a certain confidence that our services, however small and imperfect, will be approved by our most indulgent Father. And so he's saying then that we now, as justified, saved people, we obey the law as children who are bringing our always faulty, always imperfect acts of obedience to a father, knowing that even though they are faulty and imperfect, he will accept them. He'll be delighted with them. precisely because he is now our Father. And so, do you see the second point then, that we have this liberty from a terrified and reluctant obedience of God's law? Because for one thing, we want to obey God's law now. This is a desire deeply embedded in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. And then for another thing, we know that God will accept our obedience, imperfect though it is, because he's our Father. And it's not that we're trying to earn his favour by it, but we're doing it simply to please the God who has already saved us by his grace. So liberty from justification by works, liberty from terrified and reluctant obedience. But then thirdly, liberty from human rules. Liberty from human rules. And this is the section which Calvin spends longest developing. And this is how he summarizes then his main points. The consciences of believers have been delivered from all obligation to those things in which the Lord has been pleased they should be left free. I'll say it again, it's a long sentence. The consciences of believers have been delivered from all obligation to those things in which the Lord has been pleased they should be left free. In other words, then, there are a whole mass of areas of life which God has left our consciences free in. In other words, a whole mass of areas where God hasn't legislated. So he hasn't prohibited drinking alcohol. He hasn't prohibited listening to rock music. He hasn't prohibited cinema going. He hasn't legislated on the kinds of salaries that Christians should be earning. He hasn't legislated on how Christians should educate their children. He hasn't legislated on whether Christians should be buried or cremated. And so we could go on. There are all these areas where God in his word hasn't specifically and explicitly legislated. And Calvin is saying then that in those areas, men have no right to bind others' consciences. So you don't have the right to say to somebody else that you mustn't go to the cinema, or you mustn't drink alcohol, or you mustn't be cremated when you die. And similarly, that person doesn't have the right to say it to you either, because these are areas in which God hasn't legislated. He has left our consciences free, and therefore men mustn't impose rules at that point. Of course, Calvin doesn't really say this, but it's an important point, isn't it? That we may set ourselves rules in those areas. We may decide, well, I'm not going to drink any alcohol, or I'm never going to go to the cinema, whatever it might be. And that's fine. But we do not have the right to impose that rule upon somebody else. Because God alone is the Lord of the conscience. God alone has the right to impose rules and to bind people's consciences in a certain direction. Where he hasn't done that, then men don't have the right to do it. So that's what he means then by liberty from human rules. And I just want then to draw out from Calvin, first of all, two reasons why this is important, and then three notes of caution. So first of all, two reasons why it's important, this liberty from human rules. Reason number one, it was purchased by Christ. It was purchased by Christ. This is what he says. It is not to be accounted a trivial thing, which we see cost Christ so much, which he estimated not with gold or silver, but with his own blood. So that Paul hesitates not to assert that his death is rendered vain if we suffer our souls to be in subjection to men. For his sole object in some chapters of his epistle to the Galatians is to prove that Christ is obscured, or rather abolished, with respect to us, unless our consciences continue in their liberty, from which they are certainly fallen if they can be ensnared in the bonds of laws and ordinances at the pleasure of men. And so he's saying then that Christ has purchased by his own death, by his own blood, the right to be our sole legislator. He has purchased by his own blood the right to be the only one who imposes laws upon his people. And anything which was purchased through the shedding of Christ's blood surely must be valued important to us. So that's one reason why liberty from human rules is important, because it was one of those things purchased by Christ at the cross. And then the second reason why it's important is this: human rules are a slippery slope. Human rules are a slippery slope. Again, I quote, he writes, "The knowledge of this liberty is very necessary for us." And he's talking about the liberty from human rules. "For without it, we shall have no tranquility of conscience, nor will there be any end of superstitions. For when the conscience has once fallen into the snare, it enters a long and inextricable labyrinth, from which it is afterwards difficult to escape." And then he uses a couple of examples. "If anyone imagine delicate food to be unlawful, he will before long have no tranquility before God in eating brown bread and common food." In other words, if a Christian is saying to another Christian, "Look, you shouldn't be eating that food. It's too delicate. It's too expensive. It's not what a Christian should be eating." And you let that other Christian bind your conscience in that area, then soon you'll find that even brown bread you're worrying about, even common food you're worrying about. It's a slippery slope. He uses another example. "If he hesitate respecting good wine, he will afterwards be unable with any peace of conscience to drink the most dull wine. And at last he will not presume even to touch purer and sweeter water than others. In short, he will come to think it criminal to step over a twig that lies across his path. The necessary consequence is that some are hurried by despair into a vortex of confusion from which they see no way of escape." And you can see this in other areas, can't you? Think, for instance, when it comes to the Sabbath, and when it comes to kind of detailed lists of what you can and can't do on a Sunday. And the same thing happens, that when you let people kind of impose rules upon you that you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that on a Sunday, then before long you're kind of wondering, well, can I brush my teeth on a Sunday? Can I switch the light on a Sunday? And it just gets ridiculous. And it's the same kind of thing, that when we allow humanly imposed rules to bind us, then there's no peace of mind. There's no tranquility of conscience, as Calvin says that way. But soon we'll be worrying about everything, and we'll find ourselves in a labyrinth, as he puts it. So those are two reasons then why liberty from human rules is important. One, because Christ purchased this at the cross. And two, because it's a very slippery slope once we allow ourselves to be bound by other people's rules. But then, three notes of caution. And it's with this that we close. Caution number one: activities we are at liberty to engage in can still become occasions for sin. Activities we are at liberty to engage in can still become occasions for sin. And Calvin writes this: "For why are curses denounced," and this is in the Bible he's talking about, "why are curses denounced on rich men who now laugh," that's Luke 6:25, "who lie on beds of ivory," that's Amos 6:4, "who join field to field," that's Isaiah 5:8, "who have the harp and the lyre and wine in their feasts," that's Isaiah 5:12. So Calvin there has picked out a few verses from different parts of the Bible where people are denounced for doing these things, for laughing, for lying on beds of ivory, and so on. And Calvin continues, "Ivory and gold and riches of all kinds are certainly blessings of divine providence, not only permitted, but expressly designed for the use of men. Nor are we anywhere prohibited to laugh." A few people who call themselves Calvinists today perhaps could take that on board. "Or to annex new possessions to those already enjoyed, or to be delighted with musical harmony, or to drink wine." So he's saying then, these things that are cursed and denounced in these verses they're not bad things in and of themselves. Riches and laughter and possessions and music and wine, they're not bad things in and of themselves. So why then are they denounced in these passages? Well, he continues, this indeed is true. But, he says, to be immersed in sensual delights, to inebriate the heart and mind with present pleasures and perpetually to grasp at new ones, these things are very remote from a legitimate use of the divine blessings. So he's saying, yes, all those things are blessings which we are at liberty to enjoy. But he's saying that you can use those blessings in such a way that actually your liberty becomes an occasion for sin if you become obsessed with them, if they lead to idolatry. And that's still such a pertinent thing for us, isn't it? That all kinds, all the hobbies and the interests and so on that we enjoy doing, of course, they're not bad in and of themselves, and we have liberty to enjoy engaging in them. And yet, of course, any of them, all of them, can, if we're not careful, if we misuse them, can become occasions for sin. We can become too immersed in them, too obsessed with them. They can take the place in our lives which only the Lord Jesus should have. And of course, there's other ways as well in which Calvin doesn't mention, but there are other ways in which activities which we have a liberty to engage in can still become occasions for sin. Alcohol is an obvious one. So though we have liberty to enjoy wine and other alcoholic drinks, obviously there is the danger that if we drink too much, then we are transgressing the boundary and getting into sin. Or cinema going that I mentioned earlier. Again, we have liberty to go and watch films, but obviously when the content is sexually immoral or is in various ways contrary to God's will and influencing us in very damaging ways, then again, we need to stop and say, hang on a minute. So activities we are at liberty to engage in can still become occasions for sin. Second note of caution, it is sometimes appropriate to voluntarily curtail our liberty. It is sometimes appropriate to voluntarily curtail our liberty. And this is where that passage in Romans 14 comes in, isn't it? Because that's what Paul is talking about there. It's a very striking passage, isn't it, actually? Because it's a passage of two halves, a chapter of two halves, rather. Because in the first half of Romans 14, Paul is arguing very strongly for Christian liberty. He's saying that, you know, if there's someone in the church in Rome who does eat meat, then he should be allowed to eat meat. And those who don't eat meat shouldn't be trying to stop him, because he has liberty to eat meat. And so in the first half of the chapter, he's really standing up for Christian liberty. This is an important principle. But then in the second half of the chapter that we read, he's putting the other side of the coin, which is that sometimes that liberty should be voluntarily curtailed. Although nobody else has the right to curtail your liberty, sometimes you yourself should take the decision, well, I'm not going to do this thing, even though I have the right to do it, because it could be harmful to another Christian. And poor Calvin writes this then. He says, and this at first might seem a little bit complicated, but I'll explain it in a minute. He writes, I approve of the distinction between an offence given and an offence taken. So he says, if you do anything at a wrong time or place by which the weak and inexperienced believer is offended, it must be termed an offence given by you, because it arises from your fault. An offence taken, however, is when something is, through some perverse disposition, construed into an occasion of offence. We shall call the former the offence of the weak, the latter that of Pharisees. And I think it's an important distinction that Calvin is drawing here. Because I'm sure many of us are familiar then, aren't we, with this principle of curtailing our liberty so as not to offend the weaker brother, in order not to make that weaker brother stumble. But I think we could very easily therefore think that if ever anybody is offended, is upset, is put out by my conduct, by my exercise of my liberty. So by me going to the cinema or drinking alcohol or going to a rock concert or whatever it might be. If anybody is offended and put out by that, then I shouldn't do it. But that's not what Paul is saying in Romans 14. Because it might well be that that person who is put out by it isn't a weaker brother at all. It might well be that that person has been a Christian for years and is simply, as Calvin writes here, a Pharisaical brother who simply doesn't like the idea of you engaging in that particular activity. Now, Paul isn't saying we should pander around that person. But he's talking in Romans 14 about a very specific situation. He's saying that, to use the meat and vegetables example that he's using in this passage, in the Roman church there, he's saying that if you're eating meat is going to affect a young Christian who is perhaps a very timid person and who wouldn't normally eat meat, but simply because you are doing it, will go along with you and eat meat with you. And by doing so, will be sinning, because we'll be doing it not giving thanks to God for it, not glorifying God, but we'll be doing it simply out of pressure because you're doing it. Then you shouldn't do it in order to accommodate that person. So do you see the distinction that it's not simply accommodating to anybody who might be put out by us engaging, exercising our liberty. It's specifically that weak young Christian who, to use then a more modern example, who might go along to the cinema with you because you're doing it and you've invited him to go. But he doesn't think it's right. He's going even though he doesn't think it's right. And saying, don't let that person get into that situation. So it's got to be the weaker brother, not just somebody who simply saying, oh, well, I'm offended by your actions. And also Calvin adds that in such cases where we do voluntarily curtail our liberty, in such cases where we do say, well, I'm not going to engage in this activity. I could do, but I'm not going to for the sake of this other person. In actual fact, we still have our liberty at that moment. Listen to what he says. He says, if believers apprehend it to be immaterial in God's view, whether they eat animal food or eggs, whether their garments be scarlet or black, it is quite sufficient. The conscience is now emancipated. Therefore, though they abstain from meat and wear but one colour during all the rest of their lives, this is no lessening of their freedom. In other words, yes, you might say, well, I'm not going to do that thing for the sake of that person. But really, you're not lessening your freedom by doing that, because you're doing it knowing that it doesn't matter really. You're doing it knowing that to God it's immaterial whether you do the thing or not. And so you still have your freedom of conscience. You still have your Christian liberty, even at that moment when you're abstaining for the sake of that other person. And one other thing he adds in this connection, which is quite interesting. He says this. He says, it is no less advantageous to our neighbours sometimes to use our liberty to their benefit and edification than at other times to moderate it for their accommodation. And he's saying there then that just as sometimes we might curtail our liberty for the sake of somebody else, sometimes we should actually exercise our liberty for the sake of other people. And he uses the example of Paul in Galatians, I think it is Galatians 2. And this is Galatians 2, verses 3 to 5, where he writes, yet not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. This matter arose because some false brothers had infiltrated our ranks to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. We did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. So here's Paul then and this Greek man Titus, who is uncircumcised. And pressure is being put on Paul then to have Titus circumcised. Now, you'd have thought in the face of things, Paul might have just said, oh yeah, okay then, we'll have him circumcised. He has Timothy circumcised, doesn't he, in Acts 16. It was one of those areas where Paul had liberty. circumcision now in the new covenant is no longer a binding thing. You can circumcise, but you need not circumcise. And so Paul could have just gone along and said, okay, I'll have Titus circumcised. But Paul doesn't, does he? Because that would be misleading for the Christian community. It would look as though circumcision was therefore necessary for salvation. And so in that instance, Paul actually exercises his liberty not to have Titus circumcised for the sake of Christians, so that they wouldn't become confused about the nature of the gospel. And there may be times when actually we should stand up and exercise our liberty to help other Christians, to give them a clearer idea of the gospel and to avoid confusion on their part. So the first note of caution then was that activities without liberty engaging can still become occasions for sin. The second note of caution, it's sometimes appropriate to voluntarily curtail our liberty. But then thirdly, and very briefly, the third note of caution, this is, God has authorized the state to impose rules. God has authorized the state to impose rules. And Calvin just writes here, he says, we must keep spiritual liberty from being misapplied to political regulations, as though Christians were less subject to the external government of human laws because their consciences have been set at liberty before God. So he's simply saying there that God has actually given the state freedom to impose rules. So when the state says that we mustn't go more than 70 miles an hour on the motorway, we can't say, ah, but no human has a right to impose a rule on me. I can drive whatever speed I want to, because God has authorized the state, Romans 13, to do that. And so it's another note of caution, probably, I hope, very obvious to all of us, but it's something that Calvin felt important to include, that the state does have that right to do so. So those are the basic themes of this chapter then in Calvin on Christian liberty. We have liberty from justification by works. We have liberty from terrified and reluctant obedience. And we have liberty from human rules. And I hope it's something that we're clear on, and that we're enjoying, that Christ, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. That Christianity isn't an enslavement like all the other religions are, but it's a religion of emancipation and liberty and freedom. Let's make sure that we're clear on that and are enjoying the liberty which Christ has bought for us. Amen.